What's up, founders, and welcome to the In Demand podcast, where we talk all about how to troubleshoot growth for your PLG SaaS. I'm your co-host, Asia Arangio, the CEO and founder of Demand Maven.
And I'm Kim Talarczyk, client services manager at Demand Maven, where we help SaaS companies reach their toughest growth milestones.
All right, Kim, let's get into it. Okay, so we are talking about onboarding and activation today and covering a little bit of our playbook, but also a personal mission for me to implore to founders and CEOs that if you are not paying attention to activation, you are missing out on so much more revenue and also just infinitely better customer experiences, far better delighted customers. And I think activation is so overlooked. It's insane, actually, to me how quickly people look over it.
And why do you think that is?
I think it's because it feels mysterious. It goes back to one of our earlier episodes where I think a lot of people treat things like this as if it didn't have a figure-outable process. And my hope today is that we actually cover the figure-outable process. Like, there is a process to solving activation. You can go through some parts of it. You can go through the whole thing. You'll see better bang for your buck if you go through the whole thing. But even some parts of this process will dramatically shift how you think about onboarding and activation. And I think it's just, I think it's just because it's one of those like mysterious things. It has a lot of different inputs, meaning there are many different factors that play into the activation number or the activation metric. And I heard this quote recently. I think I was on Threads and someone said this, but anything that you don't understand kind of seems like magic. And the more that you understand activation, the less and less it feels and seems like magic. And I think like when I think about the practice that I've built over the last, 7 to 8 years, the more I've become very intimate with activation and I understand it. And it's not like I am certainly not perfect. And I'm still learning new things every day about activation. But it's just bonkers to me because it is a money lever to pull and so few people pull it.
Now, do most organizations have activation defined?
I don't know if I can say most because we're obviously biased in that the people that we work with tend to struggle with growth. And a lot of the times they don't have this defined. An activation metric can also look different depending on the type of company that you're in. Traditionally speaking, an activation metric is some set of behaviors that indicate that a new user has achieved either the aha moment or they've achieved a value moment of some kind where they understand, oh, this is what the product does. Okay, great. And what I find is founders and CEOs are told, you know, you should have an activation metric. And a lot of the times they kind of just pick one out of the air or they go and they look like, okay, well, what do most people do? And they kind of take it from there and they have something, but it might not actually be like a super strong leading indicator of the more that people hit this metric, the more money we're going to make. And that's the real correlation that should actually be happening.
Got it. So this is outside of, let's say, someone converting from a free trial to paid.
So yes. Now, there are two schools of thought on activation. So there are some who look at activation as what's the trial to conversion rate or like what's the new user to paying customer conversion rate. And that certainly is a way to look at activation, but it is not the only way. And I would actually say it's still missing a part of the story. The other way to think about activation is the way that I just described, which is what percentage of new signups, trialists, users, whatever, I guess, segment you want to use, what percentage of those folks hit those behaviors or reach those milestones that indicate, again, that they have achieved value and that they're probably going to become a paying customer. In the ideal scenario, the activation metric actually comes before payment. It's a leading indicator, but it can also technically be the moment of payment. But I'm going to ride this plane into the sunset on this. But the activation definition that you take has to be what serves you. Like there really is no one way to only think about this forever because depending on the company, it might actually be better from like a mental perspective to think about it in a different way. I like to actually look at it both ways. So when we dig into activation, I'm definitely digging into actual like trial to paid conversion rate. It is technically a revenue metric. We should understand that. And I'm also looking at, okay, but now how do we define activation? Like, how do we know someone has activated? How do we know someone's like gotten to that moment of value? And in a way that indicates that they are like most likely to become a paying customer. And that's the, I think, the part that a lot of people miss is they're looking at behaviors that don't actually lead or indicate that they're going to become a paying customer. They're looking at just like the most popular behaviors, not necessarily what creates revenue.
Right. Because that actually feels hard to sit down and maybe figure that out, or it might not be obvious.
Right.
And then, of course, you need to define it and it needs to be shared across the business.
Right. And it's interesting because I actually find it's less that you sit down and define it, and it's far more that you discover it. And I think that that's also the difference, is I think a lot of people think that they're supposed to sit in front of their computer and just like kind of pick something, or they're supposed to look at Amplitude or look at Mixpanel and kind of look at like, okay, well, what's the most popular thing? But really what it should be is, it certainly could be the most popular thing, but again, it really needs to be the thing that has the highest likelihood of becoming a customer. There actually is a report that I use to identify this exact thing. And anyone, like if you're using an Amplitude or Mixpanel, I want to say maybe even like a Posthog has something like this, but there is a report that you would build that is called the New User Retention Report. And what it says, and again, even if you don't have this exact report and this exact product, you can actually build it assuming that you have a good enough analytics platform. So basically what it says is, we want to look at the retention rate of a new user, someone who signs up within the first 24 hours, what percentage of people, you know, return in that first 24 hours, and then what percentage of people return day over day after that. And what you end up with is, you end up usually with a downward curve of some kind. Day zero is usually like 100%. And then day one is some other percentage. It could be 70%. It could be 30%. It could even be as low as 5%. And then there's day two, then day three. And if you have a 14-day free trial, you want to look just a little bit beyond that. So like 15, 16 days. I actually like to look even beyond that. Like I like to look, like if we know, for example, if I hear from the team, well, a lot of times people ask for extensions or what have you, I'll say, okay, well, if we have a 14-day free trial, great. Let's look at like 30, 40, and 60 days just to like see if there's anything there. But the first 5 to 10 days usually tells everything that you need to know about what your activation looks like. And what you usually end up with is, and to clarify, this is people who come back and take any activity. It could be any action at all. And you usually end up with some like baseline curve. A lot of the times when we don't have great activation, we have very depressing looking curves. So again, the new user retention report looks at what percentage of new users come back to the product after sign up and take any action at all. That's the new user retention report. And that curve is your baseline. After that, what I will then play with, and this is pure exploratory, this is that process that like, I'm not just defining it, I'm discovering it. And what I will do is I will then say, okay, that's my baseline curve. Let's now create a duplicate of this. Now I want to see what percentage of people return to the product, and what does retention rate look like if they take this action? So it could be any product action. If you have a product that, you know, you're supposed to go and build reports, okay, great. If they come back and they build a report, what does retention look like? If you have a product that translates product materials into other languages, okay, great. What percentage of people are retained if they translate a document, or if they upload a document, or if they, you know, yada, yada, yada. There's all, depending on what your product is, you really want to start looking at like all the different possibilities. And it's intuitive. So we're not going to start with something super obscure and random. We're going to start with what we think probably people should be doing if they come into our product. And then we're going to go into more and more obscure territory over time, kind of like random people come in and do like reports or whatever, but let's just see. And you're going to see different retention rates. And the ones that are always the most intriguing to me are ones that have a relatively like higher volume, like comparatively speaking. So it's a good sample size. It's not just reporting on like 5 people. It's reporting on like several hundred. And it has very strong like day one, day two, day three retention. So anything above 50%, for example, would be considered very like, that's a super strong indicator and if it has a high volume, that tells us that the people that do this, that's a very powerful moment of activation for them, or it seems to be at least.
Right. Like that user is seeing some value.
Exactly.
More than likely.
Mm-hmm. It's very likely. You could add more to this analysis. Like you could certainly filter down into people who have become a paying customer and kind of reverse engineer a little bit of like, what are the behaviors there? But that's kind of what we're looking at. And then anything that is, so let's say your baseline retention is very low. Like it's like day one, you retain maybe 10% of people. Like after the first day, like you retain a very low amount of people. But you go and you kind of like look at different product activities and you discover that, okay, well, if they do XYZ activity, it doesn't give us like 80% retention, but it gives us like 30% retention day one. That is still a net over net improvement over your baseline. So let's say it retains like 30% of people. Well, that's a 3x difference. We would still make improvements to head towards that direction. Like that's still a good indicator of like, okay, that's a worthy product behavior for us, for people to do.
Right. And somewhere to start, maybe.
It's somewhere to start. Exactly. So even if you're not seeing like, you know, the super crazy retention numbers, anything that's better than your baseline, especially if it's a multiple of X, is a go in that direction. That's still a good sign. Because I've had some teams say, well, it's not 50%, but it's like, dog, your baseline retention is 5% after the first 24 hours. Yeah. Take that 10%. It's a 2X lift.
Right. Should, like, people want like some golden,
right,
magical thing that's going to,
or they want something way out of the ballpark that we just aren't there yet. So, but like, take your wins like where,
yeah,
you can.
So it's okay to start small, it sounds like.
Totally okay to start small. I mean I would be pushing the team to be thinking bigger than if we're dealing with like super low retention numbers like that. That to me says like, okay, we've got some work to do because something is happening. Like something is happening that we can't see and the numbers just won't ever be able to tell us. Which is actually a perfect segue into the next thing that we look at. But that, the new user retention report, that is one of the many reports that you could certainly look at. Of course, we're also looking at very basic funnels, things like when they sign up, what percentage of people take the ideal next step. Again, these ideal steps are defined by your understanding of the product, but also your understanding of new users, like when they do sign up. We certainly do use session recording software. So things like Full Story, Jar, there's another one that's Mouseflow, I think is what it's called. But I would say I actually don't lean on these as much anymore, but it's just because I've been spoiled completely by UX interviews. And I certainly should start using more session recording apps, but I find you just don't know what people are thinking. The issue that I have with session recording is you have no real context for what that person is actually thinking, feeling, and doing. You're just watching their screen. But I've seen people use Zoom and go through all the emotions while using Zoom, sharing their screen, trying to find the button. And like, sometimes they don't even move their mouse. Sometimes they do. You know, so like, you just don't know. What are they? They might be fighting for their lives on the other side of the screen and you have no idea, but it looks normal to you.
Right.
Just looking
they
at their mouse move.
Cursing and throwing things.
Or the opposite, completely distracted. A baby's crying. They're eating lunch. Like you have no context. So that's kind of why I like session recordings, like conceptually, but I don't love it if that's the only thing that I have to depend on. I would rather be like, you can take it back. I'd rather just run interviews. But that's also, I think, because of my comfort level with interviews. Like, obviously, I'm very comfortable with them.
Right.
Like, I would rather watch a person actually use the product all day than try to guess what's happening in the session recording. So, but I will say, I do think that they have certainly a use. There's a lot of debate on like if that is helpful, if heat maps are helpful. Honestly, I think it's whatever ultimately helps you understand what's going on in the way that you can. But we do have to be a little bit careful about what our inputs are. So like, what information do we take in? What do we like give value to versus not? I'm going to give value to the UX interview pretty much every time.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings me to the UX interview. So whenever we start looking at activation, again, because this feels mysterious and it really, in my opinion, should not. And I think we should really tackle it more. The UX interview that we conduct, like if we know that we have an activation problem, I'm going to recommend like 3 to 5. You don't need that many. You just need 3 to 5. 3 to 5 activation interviews, UX interviews, where you are finding relatively qualified prospects. If you can't find perfectly qualified prospects, use proxies. Proxies is a fancy term for someone who's close enough to who you want to talk to. But find qualified prospects. There are two platforms that you can use. Userinterviews.com, Respondent.io. Those are the two. There have only been a handful of times in the hundreds of companies that we've worked with now, there's only been a handful of times where we have not been able to find our audience on those platforms. 95% of you who are listening right now are going to find your audience on these platforms. I guarantee it. The only time go ahead.
So how are you finding them? There's a questionnaire, right? Like our survey you're creating.
Right. So these platforms are marketplaces basically for research candidates. So you create a qualification form of some kind and, you know, they promote it to their audience. And based on the quality, like your qualification form, to be fair, it matters a lot. It takes some figuring out, I'll be honest, but your audience is 100% there. They just are. I think like there were only 2 or 3 times where we couldn't find the audience through that platform. And it was because we were trying to find a very niche, extremely niche. Like we're talking like brain surgeons in Arkansas. Niche, 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 niche. Like these people just aren't everywhere. You might as well just find them on LinkedIn and reach out to them. But all that to say, those two platforms are amazing for 95% of you. You put out your ad or whatever, you'll pay maybe like $100 per interview plus a gift card if they're professional. And you don't need 100 of them. You just need 3 to 5. And what you're going to have them do is you're going to have them sign up for your product and you're going to give them a couple of missions. You're not going to tell them what to do. You're going to ask them how they would do it. So for example, let's say I'm using translation management because that's the top of mind for me right now. Let's say you have a translation management platform. Your platform translates documents. You're not going to say, I want you to click this button. You're not going to tell them literally like what to do on the screen. You're not going to say, click that button and then go here and then do that. And then tell me what you thought about it. No. You're going to say, if you were to translate a document, how would you do that on the screen? That's what mm-hmm. you're going to do. That's the secret, because telling the beef that I have with certain types of UX interviews is that you're literally telling them what to click.
You're giving them instructions to follow.
You're giving them instructions to follow rather than a prompt where they have to figure it out. And the secret sauce is watching them figure it out. And this is where you're going to get the most value, 100%. Again, you want 3 to 5 of these. They should be relatively qualified prospects. Otherwise, you're going to use a proxy, someone close enough, because UX is relatively universal. Meaning like they don't have to be the exact type of person. Like it should be relatively close, because again, software is relatively universal. Most people have experience with software. And even then, if it doesn't work for someone who's maybe less tech savvy, then you're asking your actual real customers to do a lot of stretching, basically, is kind of the way that I see it. Hopefully that makes sense. But again, and you're going to give them prompts. You're not going to tell them how to do it. You're going to give them the high level goal. So let's say you provide attribution software. You're not going to say, okay, now set up a segment and now set up a thing and now do this. You're actually going to say, if you wanted to understand how to attribute something, how would you do that in this product on the screen? So you want to keep it high level as possible. You're not going to tell them what to click. You're going to give them a goal, a mission to complete, without describing to them how they're going to do it. And then you're going to watch them do it.
Yeah. So they're sharing their screen. You're watching them do it. And then do these people ever are they getting stressed? Are they nervous because they're sharing their screen? Or, you know, how are you then guiding them through this journey that you're taking them on?
So I, at least like at the beginning of the interview, I like to de-escalate any embarrassment as soon as possible of just being like, there are no right answers to what you're about to do. Like, I like to just make it very clear that you're not trying to do this perfectly. You know what I mean? So the respondent, the interviewee, doesn't feel like, oh my God, I'm totally failing. The thing is that people want to be as nice as possible. And also, since you're paying them, they want to feel like, oh yeah, I'm getting paid to like do a good deed. That's kind of how the psychology of most people works. But you actually don't really want that. You kind of want to see where the gaps are and what's not confusing. And what I find is yeah, like the respondent goes through the motions a lot. Like, I don't want to say that goes through the motions. It's more like they go through a lot of different types of things. Like, some things are really obvious and easy to some people, but some things are not. And what I want to implore to everybody who's listening is, just because you have paying customers of your product doesn't mean that everyone survives. Your customers are actually survivors. We call it survivor bias. The people who make it, we basically look at our customers and we say, oh, well, they made it, so the product must be fine. That's literally what happens. But that's actually not what happens in real life. So when you watch regular ass people use your product and you're actually there watching them, giving them missions to complete, not telling them how to do it, but how would you do this? How would you accomplish this mission? And actually watch them do it, you're going to find that they have a lot of struggle bus moments. There are things that are unclear. And also, you, the watcher, if you're watching this person do this, you have to also have a certain sense of resilience to not jump in and try to help them, which it takes a special kind of interviewee. It's rare that I've met a founder who's been able to be totally hands-off and be like, usually the impulse is to be like, oh, well, go here and click that and do this. And it's like, oh, okay. Right. Like, you're teaching the person. But the mission here is not, like, your product should be so freaking obvious and easy that you really don't have to do that much teaching. It truly is intuitive. And the thing is most customers blame themselves. Bob Moesta talks about this all the time. Customers blame themselves. They think that they're the problem. They don't think that you're the problem or that your product is the problem. They think that they're the problem. So they take it upon themselves to really teach themselves how to use it, because, again, they're blaming themselves the entire time. They're taking the responsibility. But this is why it's survivor bias, because the more that your customer reacts that way, there's a whole other side of the coin of people who are like, this is too fucking hard. Fuck this. Sorry for the F-bombs, but also not sorry, because that's literally what happens. So all right. That to say.
And so 3 to 5 feels low to me.
I know. And it surprises people when I say that, but you really don't need that many. And it's because until you start making changes in the product, you're going to hear and see the same bumps along the road. And what we find is, after like that 5th UX interview, you already know what the speed bumps are. You already know what the just all out walls are. It's so painfully obvious now what needs to happen that you could keep doing it, but you're just gonna get the same data points back. So you might as well make some changes and then do more.
Got it. That makes sense.
Yeah. But what's interesting is, I love the UX interview process for activation specifically because of the emotional roller coaster that you go through. And the reason why people avoid this is because it's painful as hell to watch someone struggle bust through your product. The other thing too, and I've talked a lot about this in talks like at various conferences, but again, customers blame themselves for a lot of bad experiences. They think that they're the problem, but actually no, it's the software, it's the experience. It needs to be better anyway. But what's interesting is, you have to watch what they're doing more than listen to what they're saying, because even if you ask them, was there anything difficult about uploading that document, or was there anything difficult about creating that report, there, a lot of the times people will say, they'll say verbally, no, it was so easy. But it's like, ma'am, I literally watched you struggle for your life. Like, you clicked 50 billion times all over this. You couldn't, just be honest, you couldn't figure it out, but it wasn't your fault. And that's the thing, is people think it's their fault. So they try to save face by being like, it was so easy. It wasn't easy. But they're never going to tell you that. So that's right. Why you have to do the UX interview, because you need to watch them, and you need to watch, where do they pause? Where do they get stuck? Because again, they're sharing screen. They probably have their camera on. So like, you're also looking at like their facial expressions. Like, where do they like scrunch their eyebrows? When do they click things, but it doesn't seem to do what they want to do? Or like, you know that it's not the right thing. There's all kinds of things that play into this. And like, but you really got to watch their behavior, because again, they're probably going to tell you something different. Now, sometimes it is a little rare in my experience, but sometimes you actually do get people who are very cognizant and aware of what they're experiencing. And they actually do say, yeah, that was trash. Or like, that was super hard. And I don't know why it was super hard. And also like, this button's like, you might get people who are very aware, but they're also very like, they can very clearly and specifically describe like what the challenges are, and even like point on the screen and be like, yeah, this is weird. But again, that's rare. You really just want to kind of observe people as they're given those missions or milestones that would technically indicate activation. And then from there, you start taking notes on, from a design perspective and an experience perspective, what needs to change. And I find if you just do 3 to 5 of these with just like a first batch, you're going to come away with like 20 to 30 things to go and fix in the product itself, not just tooltips and emails. What we find is like those things certainly do help. A checklist is great, like an onboarding checklist. But what we find is a lot of people ignore them. And I think we're kind of in this post-SaaS age of like, those types of things are helpful sometimes at the right time, but a lot of people have been trained to ignore them. So now it really does come down to just your actual product experience. And if that is confusing in any kind of way, you're going to see drop-off. The other thing that we think about, and then I'll pause, but the other thing that we like to think about too is, again, you're looking for friction. You're looking for places where people get stuck. You're also looking for confusion. You're looking for these types of things. In the behavioral science world, we call those barriers. So there are different types of barriers. There's cognitive overload, meaning there's too much going on. Like there's too much on the screen. I have no idea what to focus on. There's also limited attention, meaning I'm focused on other things and not what's on the screen. And so you've got my limited attention. So if there's too much visually happening, not even like it's confusing, but more just we got to make sure that we're managing the attention spans of the people that we're working with and who are like actually signing up for the product. And then certainly confusion or unclear next steps where it's not that too much is happening or that you've got my limited attention. It's really more like, I just don't know what to do next. Like it's unclear what the next steps are. So those are the three most common things that could be happening in the activation and signup experience alone. But that's what we're looking for, those moments. And you can tell because, again, they're pausing, their brow is furrowing, they're like making expressions or they're like leaning in. This happens a lot where they lean in and like you don't even see their face anymore. You see that a lot with like older generations, but even younger ones. So like you're looking for that. And I would rather have that than just a screen recording of what they're doing and not being able to see them and like talk to them. And
right. So then what? So then you're now going back to the drawing board, so to speak, or you're making updates to the design, to the product if needed.
Yeah. I'm actually out of order steps wise, but ideally, so if we've done those interviews, what we'll then go back and do is we'll say, okay, we've identified some three key areas to really put our energy towards because like these were like the top 3 to 5 areas of the product that were confusing or unclear or what have you. There was cognitive overload, there was limited attention, or there were like unclear next steps. And so what we'll then do is we'll actually take a screen by screen capture, like actual screenshots of every single thing that a person has to do to achieve those value moments. We'll put it up in a Miro board or mural or whatever you use, Lucid chart, whatever you use. And we'll actually put sticky notes on all of those unclear moments, limited attention moments, cognitive overload moments, and then also just like general notes about what we observed in the interviews. So things like that button was confusing or this copy was weird, or sometimes it's this is too much white space. Like it could be things like that. And we'll, from there, work with the product and the design team on, okay, so we have all these ideas and information, but now how do we turn these into concrete adjustments to the actual experience? And then we prioritize from there. And mm-hmm. usually what ends up happening is there's always like, this is what the ideal scenario should be. And it almost feels like a fiction because you're like, there's no way we're going to ever be able to do this. And also different parties have different opinions. And that's the other thing too. So you're going to have to negotiate with, you know, the marketing team has their opinions, product has their opinions, growth has their opinions. Everyone's got opinions. Ideally, if you're the CEO or founder listening to this, you've made it clear who's actually responsible for this and then who needs to be consulted. So really like either one person or one department or team has final say at the end of the day. Otherwise, you're going to end up in compromise land, which is really what ends up happening. So compromise land is, okay, well, like we got all this data and we got all this feedback, but you know, sales has this opinion, so I guess we'll just listen to sales. But like, okay, but maybe we'll get to do this other thing. That's compromise land. So you end up compromising with a lot of other teams, even though they might not have been part of the research. But ideally, your process leans a little bit more heavily on the qualitative and the quantitative feedback. So you can say like, look, I have actual proof that this is a problem. And ideally also, the team that is responsible for improving activation actually has the power to say yes or no, we're not doing that. Because, you know, we literally have data that says, you know, we shouldn't.
Right.
The more enterprise you go, the more you end up in compromise land. It is what it is. And I really wish it were not like that. But I think this is really where executive leadership needs to step in more and set, I think, stronger boundaries on certain things, because there's often proof about certain things working versus not working. So on the flip side, though, if your team is smaller, you have the beautiful, wonderful opportunity of not ending up in compromise land. And this is where I strive. This is where I really push teams to not end up. I'm like, please don't end up in compromise land, especially if you have a small team. If you're like a solo founder and you've got like four developers and like a marketing person, there's no reason for you to end up in compromise land.
Yeah. So in that case, who's owning it? Is it the CEO?
I mean, ideally, but I also find, depending on the organization, I've seen it vary. It could be a head of product. It could be a head of growth. Sometimes it's marketing. But what if you're going to create an activation committee of some kind, you're going to have to sort those politics first. If you especially are prone to that kind of thing, so you don't end up in compromise land. Because compromise land, what ends up happening is teams end up feeling like, oh, we spent all that time and energy doing activation, that doesn't work. But actually, no, like that version of activation, that original raw idea that you had probably was the best thing to do because it was the bigger swing or what have you. And it didn't really care about the politics as much. And that is likely going to be the thing that has the best and biggest impact. But if it gets too watered down, it's going to be watered down and you're not going to see the same level of results. And that's quite literally what happens. And it's not to say that other teams have bad intentions. It's far more that they may not understand the process. They may not understand the data that you're working with, and they may not understand fully why. And I think rarely it's that they don't care. It's usually just they just don't have all the information and insights and perspective that you do. So that's why it can be challenging in a much larger organization. But I will say that when companies, especially large ones, do get it right, it is an incredible thing to behold, because usually everyone is on board at that point with like, okay, so then any adjustments or changes you make are truly experiments, and it doesn't feel as political, mm-hmm. But it can certainly happen. So that is like those are some of the things that we do. And there are also other things that we do as well. There are certainly like, we work in the design process. Like, we are not designers, but we will work with a designer on, okay, here's maybe what the new onboarding experience should look like. There's also two certain data collection pieces that we look at. So when someone signs up, you need to be able to ideally qualify them if at all possible. This depends on the level, of course, of your business. Like, if you're targeting consumers versus not, ideally we're collecting some amount of information. And if we can't collect it, can we enrich it? That's kind of where we get into like all the other different aspects of things. But then from there, it's really, what is the version of onboarding activation that we can all agree on and get momentum behind that doesn't end up in compromise land, which mm-hmm. again, is usually a super watered down version of what you had that would have been way better and more impactful, but it gets watered down so much that it just doesn't like actually land.
Yeah. What about differences between product-led versus sales-led organizations?
Yeah, good question. So onboarding activation, it's funny because like even if you're sales-led, you should still care quite a lot, because you could be looking at pretty nasty like 12-month churn assuming that you're selling like an annual deal. So what we find with, okay, so there's product-led growth and there's sales-led growth. There are two go-to-market motions. I won't spend too much time describing them in detail here for obvious reasons, but product-led growth, the assumption here is that there is some self-serve experience that users can leverage to understand and learn the product and get a feel for it before deciding to buy it. There are different mini models inside of PLG self-serve. So there's also like sales assisted PLG, which is like you still get access to the product. You can onboard yourself. You can even buy by yourself. But if you wanted access to a salesperson, you could get one. We call it the sales assisted. And then there's the opposite side of the model, which is sales led, meaning you are not able to get access to the product unless you talk to a salesperson. Like that's generally like the concept. Product led growth, different story. You can just access it. If you are PLG, if you are purely self-serve, if you're sales assisted, whatever version you are, you're going to care a lot about activation, or at least you should, because a salesperson is not walking someone through the product. And the other thing to think about too is if it's self-serve, the first experience or touch point someone has with your brand probably will be your product. So even if they never talk to a salesperson, you're going to care a lot, or you should at least, because your product experience really has to do the selling. And if it's not doing the selling, you need to depend on a salesperson if that's the case. But in the world of software, we should all care about creating good software. The reality is very different. there are still people to this day buying enterprise software, for example, that like people still buy Salesforce, even though it is the worst experience known to man. Don't come for me, Salesforce, actually. But people still buy it. And it has a value add that is worth more than the experience of the product itself. And in those scenarios, you might actually lose money by trying to improve the experience because people buy it anyway, and because they have to in certain scenarios. That experience is not, I do not envy those designers at all.
Right.
But when it comes to, maybe you're not selling enterprise software, you probably need to care a lot about your experience, especially if it's something that you can replace relatively easily. It doesn't get super embedded. Like companies, enterprise organizations that buy Salesforce today probably can't rip it out tomorrow. I think my mom was actually complaining about this because her company was thinking about making everyone use Salesforce and then they did not. And she was like, thank God. Like she was like so relieved because she had seen it before and was just like, please no. And it's a huge organization, like hundreds of thousands of employees, huge, global. And so it was gonna roll out to everybody. And everyone was like begging to not.
What were they going to replace?
A homegrown system, which
still
exists today. Some companies still do it. But yeah, so on the sales-led side, onboarding looks different. Because usually it's more manual onboarding, or like we call it like white glove onboarding, where someone says, okay, yes, I want to become a customer. Maybe you give them a trial where you they do a demo, they're interested, there are a couple of conversations. Maybe you do give them a demo just to kind of like give them a feel for the product. But I would actually argue that even if you do that, you still have an onboarding experience. It just looks a little bit different than maybe what a PLG looks like. So even if you provision someone's account, they don't self-serve, it doesn't actually matter. That's still an onboarding experience. So when they log in for the very first time, what do they see? Whether they become a customer or not, that's actually your onboarding experience. So if it sucks, that gives people an impression. Like if it just looks hard to use, that's going to give people an impression of like, oh, I got to get on the phone with someone if I want to use this thing. Like that still has an impact on how people perceive the ease of use, but also their ability to activate. There are some products, though, that do have very high complexity. And so I want to be careful here because we have worked with companies where the product does have a high complexity. New users, new customers would not be expected to set this up by themselves. And so there has to be like an onboarding period where there are a few calls set up, likely with someone from customer success, maybe not a salesperson. Assuming they've actually become a customer, it's probably a customer success person. And that customer success person has to get the product to a state where it is now deemed usable and valuable to that customer.
Yeah.
Onboarding is again, it's on the more manual side. You might have like questionnaires for people to fill. You might have meetings that involve like talking to all the different stakeholders and really understanding like what are all the knobs I've got to turn. A great example of this is Sitecore. So Sitecore is an enterprise content management system, and you can't just go out and buy Sitecore. I haven't checked in a long time, but back in the day, you couldn't just go and buy Sitecore. You had to like talk to a salesperson, and they actually might not even be able to directly sell it to you. They might actually recommend an agency that would implement it for you. And like you buy the license maybe from Sitecore direct, but then you buy the implementation from like a third party agency. And then like they build it for you. It takes a year or whatever. Like they migrate your whole site to it and that takes a year and you pay like $2 million. And then you have 30 meetings about how to actually use it and get your whole team on board. And there are some enterprise companies that have certainly seen success with Sitecore, but you can imagine all those different touch points could have points of failure. Like there are moments where people might get confused or lost, or they're like, it's like that situation I told you about with Salesforce, like, please don't buy this. And no one wants to, because literally no one will use it. Or you're going to have to force your team to use it or what have you. Like there's all kinds of things that could go wrong. And so you have to think about onboarding more like almost like a consultative play. And again, if that's a very, that's a very high ticket value, high complexity product for a very large organization, and there's different degrees and variances of that. And some, you know, some are much smaller, obviously, like maybe onboarding is like two or three sessions and that's it. But you just have to think about, even in that scenario, you're going to have drop off, you're going to have moments of confusion, and you're still going to want to tighten that up anyway. And especially too, like in those scenarios, what we typically see for sales-led organizations, they're usually selling some type of annual deal or sometimes even like a two-year deal. And you should still care about onboarding because it's going to impact, again, that success level that someone has. And also, you're going to learn a lot about the customer in the process, especially if they thought that it did something and it didn't, and it doesn't do it. You end up learning about all the gaps that, like, maybe expectation-wise that they had, and that's going to help impact, like, that's going to impact your churn.
And your time horizon might be longer, like if you have that 1 year or 2 year plan.
Right.
That you're looking across data across a longer amount of time.
Right.
But it still applies.
Exactly. And so even though you're not self-serve, you still have to care about product experience. And that is a huge reason why. Now, I think a lot of sales-led organizations get a little lazy because in their minds, they're like, oh, well, we don't have to worry about this until 1 to 2 years from now. But what inevitably happens is people lose track of time, and then they're surprised later by churn when people don't renew. They're shook because they're like, how could this happen so quickly? Just yesterday we were signing and onboarding, and it's like, well, they probably didn't get the success that they needed to get in those first 30, 60, 90 days, like whatever that time horizon actually is. And if it's a long time horizon, so like a Sitecore, for example, it's years. But then again, it's, you know, shocking, like, oh, we lost that big Fortune like 100 company. How could this possibly have happened? And it's like, if you've been paying attention for 3 to 5 years, all the signs are there, which I've right. seen. I've seen that before. And it was a lot of the same reactions, I feel like, every time. But anyway, that's an example. And even if you're sales-led, you still got to think about this, but it might just not be all on screen. You've got to think about the offline onboarding and the online onboarding. They mm-hmm. both play together. With a self-serve, you're really more thinking about online onboarding, and you might have a customer success team that does do a little bit of like the offline kind of touch points, things like phone calls, stuff like that. Otherwise, for the most part, it's online as well. It's probably via email. Rarely have I seen text-based onboarding, but I have seen it before, with especially like with B2B SaaS, like signing up for a SaaS product, they get my phone number, they're texting me like updates. I've seen it, and it's actually kind of compelling sometimes. It just depends on what it is though. But you still got to think about both.
That makes sense. Is there anything else we should cover about onboarding and activation?
Oh, actually there is something I wanted to make sure to share. So there are a couple of places that I want to make sure that people know that they can go to learn more about onboarding activation. And the first resource is, I'm going to recommend Ramley John's book, Product-Led Onboarding. It's a great read. It's a fast read. It's got a lot of pictures in it. It's like, it's fast. Like, you will be able to read this in like 2 to 3 hours. And we do leverage a lot of what Ramley recommends. And so it's not, you know, just, I'm not an activation genius. I have learned from other activation and growth geniuses. And so what I think is really fun, though, is I love applying what I learn, and that's what motivates me the most. So learning new things from folks and then applying it is like one of my greatest joys and passions. And product-led onboarding is a great example of learning what to look for and then applying it. Now, there are some things that we don't do that Ramley recommends, but it's just more contextual. But that's a great read. The other person that I often look to, at least when it comes to, I love his onboarding teardowns, but Samuel Hulick of useronboard.com, another excellent resource. I love watching the teardowns. It's funny because the more I learn about activation, the more, and I apply things myself, of course, you start to develop like your own perspectives. And what I really like about Sam in particular is how different his perspective is from mine. And so that's what I just appreciate his perspective on things. Even if we don't always agree on everything, I still like knowing how he thinks. So
yeah. In what ways?
Yeah. So
his perspective different.
So funny. Cause like the thing that comes to mind is if you are B2B PLG self-serve, I think that you should have some type of pre-qualification form of some kind, like when someone signs up. Now, I'm not talking like 10 questions. I'm talking like add like 2 to 3 questions to your signup flow, because my angst when it comes to bootstrap founders trying to do activation themselves is they've been told their whole lives have the simplest form ever, just name an email address. But I find that to be deeply frustrating, because when you're a growth person trying to figure out like who the best paying customer is, what people actually want out of the product, unless you talk to them, you just don't know. And so what I recommend is, okay, well, name an email address, fine. We obviously need that. But like, can we add like 2 to 3 extra questions to get the data that we would need to make good informed business decisions on who this audience is? Because 9 times out of 10, if a founder's never worked with a growth person before, which at least in the bootstrap world can be pretty often, what ends up happening is we're like, okay, well, what percentage of your trial sign up pipeline is qualified? And no one has the answer. And that's a problem, because if only 10% of it is qualified and 90% of it is not, that tells me that we're acquiring the wrong users and the wrong traffic and blah, blah, blah. And there's so many other things too that it impacts. Like, that data impacts not just activation and acquisition, but it impacts churn as well. Like, how many founders can actually say, oh yeah, like this is what our qualified churn looks like and this is what our unqualified churn looks like? It's rare. I don't think I've met a founder who's had those two metrics. Literally, like the last time I saw those metrics were when I was on the board of Moz. And You need those metrics. Like, eventually, like you mature to a certain state where like you need those numbers. And the only way to know is to qualify your users. But Sam disagrees with this. He very much, and actually, I got to update my thinking on this too, because he might actually only disagree with this in certain contexts. But from what I've seen of his work, he's on the camp of like, no, reduce friction as much as possible. And I'm of the camp of like, well, some friction is okay. If it means we can make better decisions later.
That it does seem like that is a little bit old school, or could be maybe just, and yes, less friction makes sense. But in some cases, especially PLG, SaaS, it does make sense, I think, to add a few more questions. And it doesn't necessarily cause so much friction that you're going to deter a bunch of people.
Yeah. But, you know, I have not, that was a few years ago that I remember seeing that from User Onboard, at least. And so he might have updated his position. He also might only feel that way about certain scenarios. So to be fair, I don't have all the context here, but
yeah.
But I do remember being like, I was surprised by that, because I was like, oh, like I just don't know how we would, unless you retroactively qualify people, like using like an enrichment tool, it's actually really hard to get good data on who people are, especially like if they use like a Gmail address. So my whole thing was like, yeah, like I could see how that could be annoying. But when it comes to being able to make like good decisions, we need that data, because otherwise you end up kind of like spinning your wheels a little bit, because you basically treat every user as if they were a good user. But that's actually not true. Not every user is going to be a qualified user. They're just not.
Right.
Otherwise, like, you know, this whole growth thing would be so easy, like if everybody was just qualified, but they're not. So you need a way to understand to what degree are they qualified, what percentage of them are qualified, and then how many people who become customers were actually qualified based on like our own understanding of the data. But I also think it just does different things. Like it impacts different ways that you think about your funnel and like your growth model in general, because it can be questioned. And I think the people that you think are qualified actually might not be accurate. So that's happened before too, where we come in and we're kind of like, oh, it seems like your qualified user looks like this. But when we actually got the data, we were like, actually, seems like a better user is over here and they're making you more money. And so that's also why we measure and track that kind of thing.
I was just going to say, any other resources that you like for onboarding and activation?
Yeah, it's funny. I used to recommend Reforge for people who really are like if you are not a founder, and even if you are a founder, you can certainly look at Reforge. But if you are someone who's like a voracious learner, you like to like take classes and courses and that type of thing, Reforge has a couple of extra or excellent programs on activation and onboarding. And I think too, they're really working on distilling their content. So it doesn't take 24 hours to complete a course. It maybe will only take like 2 to 3 now. So I think that they're working on that. They know that that's like a challenge, I guess, for new users. But you can buy their course material for a very reasonable rate. I think it's like $1,000 a year is what it used to be. They have excellent content on this, and I've learned a lot from them as well. But otherwise, Ramley's book is a quick read. You can learn so much from that. I can't remember if he talks about UX interviews, but that is something that I would add to that process. So you could totally follow Ramley's process. I would add UX interviews to it because I think that really gives you like the juicy details of what's really going on. Mm-hmm. But I think his overall process is an excellent one.
Nice. Anything else we didn't cover?
I think if there was any parting wisdom, I would just remember that if you're a founder and you're listening to this, your customers are survivors. And everyone else who does not become a customer was not a survivor, even if they were qualified. So you can't look at your customers and assume that just because you have customers that your activation is amazing and is perfect and there's nothing wrong with it. Because again, they're survivors. And we are so prone to survivor bias. We assume that if people made it, it must be fine. You see that all over the United States and America in our culture. If people make it, it must be okay. Meanwhile, people are like struggling. We should have that meme where it's like the mom like in the pool with her kids and she's like looking at her daughter, but like the son is like over in the corner, like drowning literally. And like, it needs to be, it's literally that meme. It's that meme all day long. And we're going to put it in I don't know if we can put images in the description box, but we'll definitely put it in the article because it is literally that meme. We are so prone to survivor bias, and you just have to remember and consider that just because your customers made it doesn't mean that onboarding activation is perfect. I would actually beg to differ. I think it's really more like, no, your customers are survivors and they're just built different. And there's a whole swath of people who are not. And they were like, this sucks. I hate it. I'm leaving. And they're qualified. Like, they're perfectly qualified.
Yes. You can get them into some adjustments.
We have one last thing, and I just remembered this. And back in the day, I think we still do this. So whenever we work on activation projects with clients, we will actually ask for interviews with trialists who didn't become customers. Sometimes we do get lucky and we're able to get people on the phone with us. A lot of the times we're not, but we still try anyway. But those are also fascinating too, because you either learn like, oh, they were qualified and we lost them. That sucks. Or you learn, oh, actually, they weren't qualified and we're not mad about losing them. And sometimes that context also helps a lot. But anyway, yeah. I digress.
Yeah. No, this was good advice. Hopefully it was helpful for people, and people should reach out and ask questions if they are struggling or have questions about their own activation process.
Totally. I'm an open book, so let me know if there's anything I can help with.
Great.
Thanks.